listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm so glad to be with all of you today. I have a great show. My guest will be Tamar Haspel. She is a journalist for the Washington Post and writes a monthly column called Unearthed, and also has a great blog called Starving Off the Land, and she'll be coming on in just a little bit, and we'll tell you more about her then. But first, I want to just tell you about some things going on around the city, share with you what I got to do this week, which was go to the Food and Enterprise Summit and the Chefs Collaborative Summit, since I spoke to all of you last. Both of these events were absolutely, wonderful and inspiring to be at. The Food and Enterprise Summit was organized by Slow Money, New York City. And Slow Money is an organization that's bringing together entrepreneurs and investors to invest in our local food system. And, they certainly focus on sustainability and companies that are startups that are hopefully going to keep the money close to home and change the local food system. So they had a lot of really great ideas. It was not surprising to hear that they said cannabis is going to be the new gold rush. And I think we're already seeing that in California and Colorado. And as it becomes legal in more states, more opportunities will open up with that. But, the innovation that's going on around cannabis, both from cooking, baking, oils, all kinds, and then you get into hemp clothing. There's so much innovation that's going on around that, and because for so long growers had to grow indoors, I think a lot of that innovation that they've been using for cannabis is also being able to be transferred into indoor other forms of agriculture, microgreens and things like that. So a lot of the innovation that was specialized around cannabis is now also being used for growing other foods indoors so that people can have fresh local foods 24/7. So anyway, some really great things. One thing that really stood out for me was a keynote speaker, Michelle Long, who has a organization called Bali, Be a Localist, and she was just inspirational in her talk. Check it out, Bali, Be a Localist. And her organization is really just building a community of entrepreneurs who understand that to really be successful, your whole community has to be successful. And so it's trying to change the agenda so that it's not, all about me and me becoming successful as much as about us and we becoming successful. And so it's neighbors helping neighbors, business people helping each other out, offering support, collaboration, cooperation, all these words that we don't usually think of when we're thinking of business. And her model is really, trying to spread the love. I mean, it might sound corny, but it really was beautiful. And I think she had the whole room almost in tears. It was really great. So anyway, hoot out to Michelle Long. It was wonderful. Also, then I went to the Chefs Collaborative Summit on Monday, and that is an organization. Chefs Collaborative is an organization of chefs that care about sustainability and healthy food and really are trying to change menus, change lives. That's their tagline, change menus, change lives. And they're doing just that, sourcing local food, sourcing sustainably raised food, line-caught wild fish, grass-fed animals, so that they're really just upping the ante, helping to spread awareness and making their customers aware that there's a difference of quality in the foods that they're serving. And, many of these chefs also then take it to the next level with composting and separating trash and really trying to be good stewards of the earth. And so there was a lot of that interchange going on. It was really great. The lunch was amazing. Diggin offered all these kinds of vegetables, and then Bear Burger actually partnered with Impossible Burger, and they served vegetarian, vegan, vegetarian burger that was so meat-like it was almost weird. It was almost difficult to eat. It was like juicy like a burger, and it was red like a burger, bounced like a burger. I mean, it was so burger-like, it's really strange. One wants to know what's in it, but supposedly everything good and natural is in it. So watch for that. It's called the Impossible Burger, and Patrick Brown, the founder, I'm going to try to get on the show in a few months and talk to us more about that. But anyway, both these summits were really inspiring, lots of great interchange going on, and it was really fun to be there. Lots of other great things going on in and around the city this week. Slow Food East End is having their movable feast this weekend, April 17th. And the movable feast is part of the Joshua Levine Memorial Foundation and Slow Food East End coming together to do a fundraiser for Edible School Gardens. So if you're out by the East End, this is in Sag Harbor on April 17th, and should be a fun event. April 18th, Wellness in the Schools, which is a great nonprofit organization headed up by Bill Talapan, is having their gala, and that is at the Tribeca Rooftop. Wellness in the Schools brings just what it says, school gardens and healthier food into New York City public schools, so they could use your support. Next week, actually, I'll be recording my show down in Washington, D.C. at the Food Tank Summit. Food Tank is a wonderful organization that is raising awareness about our local food system and sustainability and just really looking at our food system in general. So it's looking at the problems with the food system and looking at the heroes that are really trying to change the food system to be a better food system. And Food Tank also looks at the food system in other countries and around the world and how we're going to feed the 9 billion people that are going to be on this planet. So anyway, that summit is next week on April 20th and 21st, Wednesday and Thursday. And Thursday, like I said, I'll be interviewing a few people that are down there at the summit for my radio show. April 21st, there's a Growing Farmers Initiative. This is a free event up at Stone Barn Center for Food and Agriculture. That's an educational center that's really wonderful. They bring lots of great workshops and events to the public. And this is a conference, if you will, from 12:30 to 3:30 about growing organically. So it's really it should be a great event. And they are also having their annual sheep shearing festival on April 30th. So if you haven't been to Stone Barns, it's a wonderful place to go to, so I recommend checking it out. May 7th and the 8th is the New York Vegetarian Food Festival. May 7th is the 5th annual Riverkeeper Sweep, which is, people getting together, helping clean up the shores of the Hudson River. And so you just go to riverkeeper.com website and find out where they are cleaning up the river in your local area. Also, May 15th, Panorama Living is having an event out at Martha Clara Vineyards. Dr. Michael Greger, author of How Not to Die, is the keynote speaker there. There will be other specialists in mindfulness and other topics. Definitely worth checking out. That is going to be out in Riverhead. I have lots of events on my website, so check it out at iegreen.com. I don't want to take any more time right now, but there's lots of great events listed there, so check them out. In the news, I don't know if you guys saw the article about milk getting into the small batch brewing. So instead of micro breweries, we now have micro dairies. And, it's, again, just looking at the quality of the food, trying to move our food away from industrial production, back to where you know the farmer, you know who's making it, you know the efforts that are going into it, you know the quality. Unfortunately, it is more expensive, but for those of us that can afford it, it is certainly a pleasure. And for those of us that can afford it, we can actually do some work to try to make it more accessible for everybody. So, you know, I talk to people about this a lot, volunteering, fundraising, getting involved is really something that we all need to take on. We all can't do everything, but we all can do something. And so if you are not participating with some nonprofit in trying to help move an issue that you're passionate about forward, think about doing that. We all have our passions and we all have things that are important to us, and we all need to actually, you know, put the nose to the grindstone and do something about it. So helping to make food more accessible to all those people that are in need. Everybody has a right to good quality food, and that's really going to require us to change some policies. So check it out and get involved. Strawberries have made it to the top of the Dirty Dozen list. So as spring comes and we start seeing more and more strawberries, even local strawberries, make sure that they're organic, because if they're not, they are sprayed with, you know, this article said some strawberries had more than 70 different chemicals, pesticides, and herbicides on them. So they are at the top of the Dirty Dozen list. So don't eat them unless they're organic. And also the Agriculture Department, USDA, is finally getting involved in trying to improve some of the standards for organic chicken and meat. That was an interesting article in the New York Times, so check that out. Okay, I want to share with you a recipe before I invite my guest, Tamara Haspel, on. One of the things that my guest does is she has an oyster farm up off of the coast of Cape Cod, and so I thought it would be a really good opportunity to share with you a recipe for po' boy oysters. This is a recipe that we served at the Slow Food Film and Feast Festival that we had a couple of weeks ago, and everybody was asking me for the recipe. And so I knew Tamara was coming on the show, so I saved it. So this recipe is very simple to make, delicious. Just think ahead a little bit so that you can marinate your oysters for a little bit in a marinade. And this marinade is 1 cup of buttermilk, 1 teaspoon of Old Bay spice, and 1 tablespoon of a Cajun spice. I use an emerald essence, but you can use any Cajun spice. You can actually go online and find that recipe for making up your own Cajun spice mix. But anyway, you're going to marinate the oysters in that for at least 30 minutes. I did it for a couple hours. And then the breading is 1/2 cup of masa harina, which is cornmeal that has some lime in it, and 1/4 cup of unbleached white flour or gluten-free flour. Now, I used gluten-free flour because I was making everything gluten-free since I was serving a large crowd and I didn't want to have to do a separate batch. So I used gluten-free flour, 1/4 cup of panko flakes or gluten-free breadcrumbs, another tablespoon of the emerald essence, 1/2 teaspoon of Old Bay spice, 1 teaspoon of another Cajun spice blend, and 1 teaspoon of lemon zest. And that's the breading. And then the sauce was a Cajun remoulade sauce, and that's 1 cup of organic mayo, 1 teaspoon of dry mustard, 1 tablespoon of fresh lemon juice, 2 tablespoons of horseradish, 2 teaspoons of jalapeno hot sauce, 1 1/2 teaspoons of German mustard, 1 teaspoon minced garlic, 2 teaspoons of capers, and 2 teaspoons of ketchup. And so first I made the marinade, and I marinated the oysters for 2 hours in the refrigerator. And then in a separate bowl, I combined the ingredients for the breading, and I removed the oysters from the marinade. I dredged them into the bread mixture. And then in a heavy cast iron skillet, You can deep fry them, or if you have a deep fryer, set at 360 degrees. And you fry the oysters just for about 2 minutes until they're golden brown on all sides. Sure, if you'd like, you can try baking them on a cookie sheet with that's sprayed with oil, and also I would spray the top of the oysters with oil, and you can probably bake them for 10 minutes in a 400-degree oven, and they'd probably be good too, maybe even less than 10 minutes, but I think just until they're golden brown. And in a blender, I mixed all of the ingredients for the sauce, and I served it drizzled over the oysters, and it was really great. I garnished with chopped parsley to make it look pretty, and that was it. As always, if you make the recipe, please send me either some photos, send me some feedback. Love to hear from all of you. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Tamar Haspel. Her blog is called Starving Off the Land, and she is a journalist for the Washington Post. She has a monthly column called Unearthed, which covers all kinds of food supply issues, from biotech, pesticides, food additives, antibiotics, organic nutrition, and food policy. She's won a James Beard Award in 2015, and her column was also selected for the best food writing in 2015. So it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Tamar Haspel. Tamar, are you with me?
I am with you, Bhavani. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Just fine, thanks.
Great. So I was hoping you could just start by telling some of my listeners how you got started. What inspired you to become a food writer? How long have you been doing it? All that kind of stuff.
Well, I've been doing it so long I can barely remember what inspired me to do it in the first place. I mean, I think food is interesting to everybody, and it's always been interesting to me. Back in the day, it was back in the 90s, my mother and I actually published a newsletter called Dreaded Broccoli. It was about, you know, it's sort of a food enthusiast take on healthful cooking and eating. And it sort of, it got a readership, and then we got interest from an editor at Scribner, and we wrote the book, and that opened the freelance doors for me. And so, you know, I've been writing about food ever since. But different aspects of food. I've written about nutrition a lot, and lately more about agriculture and you know, policy and environmental issues and things like that.
Yeah, there's a lot to write about, right? It's constantly changing.
You never run out.
Right, and transparency is a real issue.
Trying to get a huge issue.
Go ahead.
I know it's something that's on a lot of people's minds, and people are pushing hard for more transparency. And you know, it's kind of a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, I think everybody wins when they know more about their food. On the other hand, some of the things that capture the public's imagination, things like GMOs and chemicals in their food, are not really the things that are dangerous. And sometimes we end up with a situation where, you know, large companies and sometimes government officials are responding to public pressure that is a little bit divorced from the science. So I think we're all, you know, who are concerned about the food supply, trying to find a constructive way forward in that environment.
Mm-hmm. However, I think, like we were just saying, transparency is the best. That way people can make up their own decision. I personally try to avoid GMOs. I mean, I don't think that they're good for us. There's not a lot of science out there, because we can't do the testing, and, you know, the biotech companies are the ones that fund the testing.
Well, Bhavani, I guess I'm going to have to stop you there. And I guess since you invited me on, knowing I write about food policy, GMOs is one of the things I write about, and
I know.
I've spent a whole lot of time with the evidence, and you're repeating some things that really aren't supportable once you start spending time with the science on these things. It's certainly true that a lot of the biotech companies have done research on genetically modified crops. I mean, they're required to, essentially. But I think a good half of the research that's out there on GMO safety has now been done by organizations that aren't the biotech industry. And if you look at that evidence in total, it's pretty compelling. And, you know, if you compare it to something like, say, climate change, I mean, do you believe that climate change is real and happening and human?
Of course.
So, and 97% of scientists are in that camp. If you ask those same scientists, do you believe genetically modified crops are safe? And I, you know, it was a Pew study, and I think the number was something like 93% said that genetically modified crops were safe. Yet that is not persuasive to you. And I think that what's happening here is that a lot of issues get conflated. Whenever we put something out there in the food supply, it has repercussions. And putting crops that are resistant to an herbicide, glyphosate, has definitely raised problems with resistance that weeds have developed to that herbicide. There are definitely issues there. But I think we can have a better conversation about genetically modified crops if we separate the issue of whether they're safe to eat from the issues that have environmental repercussions. And so, you know, let me ask you, why do you believe the scientists on the issue of climate change, but you don't believe the scientists on the issue of GMO safety?
Well, I guess the scientists, you know, so many of the scientists that speak out in favor of GMOs are being funded by the GMO companies.
But this isn't those scientists. This is a body of scientists that is surveyed by the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Scientists. They're not biotech employees. And the consensus is just as robust on GMO safety as it is on climate. Yet you don't find that persuasive.
Right. Yeah, you're right. I don't. I guess I'm reading different articles than you are. I don't know the consensus. And, you know, afterwards, you know, you can send me some stuff and I'd love to look at it. But I have done, you know, a lot of looking, and I've had, you know, interviewed many people who have done work with GMOs as well. And, you know, the information that I have and the view I have is that it's not safe and that it's not proven safe. And, you know, and like you said, certainly the environmental repercussions are so bad alone that that's worth looking into. But, you know, all the things that the GMO biotechs had promised us of greater yields and less pesticide use didn't end up being a fact either. We actually, you know,
eating the wine of the anti-GMO activists. And the reality is that it's way more complex than that. And there are certainly times and places where genetically modified crops have drastically increased yields. And, you know, just recently there was a report on BT eggplant in Bangladesh and the dramatic impact that it has had on farmers' lives. Not only has it increased yield, it has radically decreased the spraying of pesticides. And I guess it's disturbing to me when people who care about our food supply, who care about our environment, are willing to dismiss wholesale a technology that has, you know, incredible promise in a lot of ways. And, you know, I'll be the first to talk about the shortcomings of the deployment of the technology in our food supply, because I think that there have been some significant shortcomings. But I think we have a baby in bathwater situation here. And if you dismiss GMOs wholesale based on, you know, your reading of the evidence, which contradicts that of the scientific consensus, then what you're dismissing are projects like, you know, when I was in Kenya last year and I got to go visit a scientist who is working on a problem of bacterial wilt in bananas. And she has developed a banana that has a green pepper gene in it that is completely resistant to this disease, which is devastating the banana crops of small subsistence farmers, and you know, bananas are a subsistence crop in Uganda. And you know, is that something you want to take away from those farmers?
No, but I guess I think it's different when you're cross splicing, you know, another vegetable with another vegetable to make it resistant, as opposed to with a chemical.
Well, you know, we could talk about the technical aspects of what genetic modification actually is, but I would ask you to remember what you just said the next time you have a conversation about genetic modification, that sometimes, in some circumstances, it can be a really terrific and literally a life-saving technology. And so if we're going to have a nuanced, constructive conversation about these things, saying, you know, no, no, GMO doesn't allow for that. And so instead of talking about GMOs in general, I try and talk about them in particular. Okay, let's talk mm-hmm. about herbicide tolerance. Let's talk about BT, because I think actually the, you know, the BT crops have been super effective at decreasing pesticide use. But everybody just lumps them together and takes the problems that we've had with herbicide-tolerant crops and just is ready to dismiss genetic modification altogether. I think it's very frustrating, and I think it's unlikely we're going to see improvements in our food supply unless we have more nuanced conversations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I can tell that we are a little bit on different sides there, and so I just want to move away from it for a little bit so our whole conversation is not focused just on GMOs, because there's a lot of other things that I know you can bring to the table that I would like to share with my listeners, and we can come back to the GMOs towards the end of the show. How's that?
I can talk about anything you want to talk
okay.
about.
Okay. So I had read an article that you wrote about these scanners that are going to be able to, that people will be able to bring into the supermarket and scan, you know, fruit or vegetable and find out its origin, find out, you know, its nutritional level. I know when I was at the Milan Expo, there was a supermarket for the future where you could just put your hand over some produce and up on the screen it would say, you know, where the produce came from and its nutritional value. So anyway, so I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about these scanners that you wrote about, and whether or not, I was also curious whether or not it does say the origin, whether it's a genetically modified crop or organic and that kind of thing.
Well, it all depends on whether the origin or the genetic modification is something that is reflected in the optical scan, because this is an optical technology. And I know that, you know, most of us, when you know, we were in junior high school or high school, took a chemistry class where we used an optical spectrometer that you read the identity of a chemical based on the pattern of light that it reflects and absorbs. And this is exactly the same thing. Just like you can identify a chemical, you can identify, say, a wine, you know, a 2012 Merlot from a particular vineyard reflects light in a particular way. And if you scan it and it doesn't match that scan, then it's not that Merlot. Now, some of these jobs are much easier than others. So the first applications we're going to see for this technology are simply applications where you match the spectrograph, the basically the optical fingerprint of the food to a library of fingerprints, just like, you know, if I were arrested for a crime, my fingerprint would be matched to fingerprints in a database.
Mm-hmm.
You know, around, if they found a fingerprint, they'd match it to a library of fingerprints. And so the most straightforward applications are things like, what kind of cheese is this? What kind of wine is this? When you start getting into nutrient values, it gets a lot more complicated, because not only are you matching a scan to a library of scans, you're trying to read the topography of the scan. So there's a particular peak here or a valley here in the graph, and that could mean vitamin A. It could mean a particular kind of sugar. And to be able to do that read, you have to have an extremely robust library of products that you can match it against. Now, sometimes you're going to be able to identify a genetically modified product. Say, let's talk about the genetically engineered salmon that has been engineered to grow faster on less feed. That salmon is, in all probability, and I can't say for sure because I haven't seen the scans myself, in all probability you're going to have a scan that's going to look different from an Atlantic salmon or a Pacific salmon, a Chinook salmon, or a King salmon. And in that case, you will be able to modify it. On the other hand, let's say we're looking at sugar. So sugar that's derived from genetically modified beets is chemically and physically indistinguishable from sugar that is derived from sugarcane. So in that case, no, it's not going to be useful to you. So it all depends on the genetic modification. And I think that we're going to see these innovations first in the supply chain. So Target, for example, has scanners in their distribution centers where they're building these libraries. And, you know, it's a huge job to do this, and somebody with deep pockets like Target has to undertake it. You know, when we're going to see these in our cell phones, you know, my guess is that simple applications will be in the next few years. More complex applications are going to be farther down the road.
Mm-hmm. I had taken a bio-nutrient soil class, and they were talking about these scanners that actually would show the BRICS level or the nutritional level of a product. You know, I think many of us interested in food know that a lot of the fruits and vegetables we're seeing today don't have the same nutritional value that that same fruit or vegetable had, you know, say 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, usually it's measured by the BRICS, this scanner that will say, you know, whether or not, how nutrient dense it is.
Well, just to be clear, BRICS doesn't measure nutrient density. BRICS specifically measures sugar levels. So nutrient density is a series of measurements, each measuring a different nutrient. So BRICS is specifically sugar level.
Okay. So it's not my understanding was that it also, based on the sugar level, determined its nutritional value. Is that not correct?
No, that is not correct.
Ah. Okay. Well, will these new scanners address the nutritional value of the vegetable? Because I know there's been lots of research done as to, you know, fruits or vegetables grown in really rich soil being healthier for you than fruits and vegetables grown in depleted soil.
Well, not to be a contrarian, but there's actually not a lot of research done on whether fruits and vegetables grown in rich soil have a higher nutrient density than fruits and vegetables grown in other kinds of soils. In fact, the research on, say, organic versus conventional is pretty much equivocal that, you know, they're essentially the same. And although it makes intuitive sense that a richer soil, and there's certainly advantages to richer soils, will produce a more nutrient-dense vegetable, it really doesn't pan out when people actually start doing the measurement. However, that said, on any given day, you can walk into a grocery store and there are going to be, probably at least three or four kinds of spinach. There's going to be organic spinach. There's going to be conventional spinach. There's going to be canned spinach. There's going to be frozen spinach. And to be able to point an optical scanner at each of those things and say, well, on this day in my market, this particular spinach is the most nutritious, is really valuable. And what it does is it gets us around this whole argument about whether, you know, does organic spinach have more nutrients than conventional spinach? You know, how does that really matter to somebody who shows up in the supermarket and has a choice of two different kinds of spinach? What matters to that shopper is those two samples of spinach, whether one is local and one is from far away, one is organic, one is frozen. And to be able to give that capacity to the individual shopper means maybe we can stop shouting about some of these things.
Mm-hmm. And so will that scanner be able to do that?
Eventually. But I think, as I said, that's something to be able to read the nutritional content is a much more complicated job than being able to simply match a scan. And eventually that will be able to do that. At first, I think, as I said, you're going to see that capability in the supply chain. And so you're going to see, for example, Target being able to tell you what the nutritional content is of this particular apple or this particular cabbage. Eventually, that will probably filter down to the consumer level.
Mm-hmm. I think it would be great when that does happen because I know.
I agree.
Yeah, people certainly care about that. We're going to take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I would like to talk about the article you wrote on 10 things we should do to fix our broken food system. Maybe you can share that. Okay?
Excellent.
Everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Tamara Haspel from The Washington Post. Be right back. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest is Tamara Haspel. Her blog is Starving Off the Land, and she writes a monthly blog for the Washington Post called Unearthed. Tamara, are you with me?
I am.
Great. So you had written an article on the 10 things we should do to fix our broken food system. And I thought maybe you could just, touch on those, but then I really wanted to focus on the subsidies because, with the Farm Bill coming up again, I think, so many people don't really understand how those work and how those are not really helping our food system.
Well, and again, you have a position on this that I'm not sure I would completely agree with, but and I would also be quick to point out that the Farm Bill is hugely long and complicated, and I would never set myself up as a Farm Bill expert. That said, I think that it's important that we start looking at our subsidy programs a little bit differently. And one of the things that I would like to see happen is to have the same level of subsidies for every kind of food that farmers grow. So right now, basically, we're subsidizing in two ways. We're subsidizing more than two ways, but there are two major ways in which we're subsidizing. One is that we're helping farmers pay insurance premiums when they insure their crop. And second, we have layered on top of that programs for commodity crops like corn and soy and wheat and cotton, where there are special price protections for farmers to be protected in case prices dip. Very low. And we're seeing this year, because crop prices are so low, we're seeing record payouts for farmers. And on the one hand, I think everybody wants farmers to be able to stay in business. On the other hand, I think it's important that we not give farmers a particular incentive to grow the crops that aren't contributing to the most nutritious parts of our diet. And corn and soy, as I'm sure you know, go in primarily to animal feed, and corn also becomes biofuel. And so they also have byproducts that go into processed food. These are not the backbone of a nutritious diet. And I would certainly like to see subsidies rejiggered so that all farmers have the same kind of insurance premium protection, and I'm in favor of phasing out the commodity program.
In favor of phasing out what?
The commodity program.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, there's a limit to who the subsidies can go to, right? It's not really for all farmers. It's really only for the largest farmers or the biggest farmers.
No, that's just wrong. There are subsidies available in all kinds of different ways. And, in fact, the risk management part of the USDA, which is that's the agency that does the crop insurance subsidies rather than the commodity programs. They have been working very, very hard to try and make those subsidies available for more crops and more farms. And just last year, they introduced a program that was based not on the crops you grow, but on the revenue from your farm, that will allow small farmers, diverse farmers, to have another way to get subsidies to reduce their risk.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I thought it really primarily went towards the larger farmers and the farmers that, you know,
well,
do grow.
Well, by dollar value, it certainly does. And, you know, on the one level, that makes sense. The people who produce the most food actually do get the most in subsidies. But this idea that we're only paying it to large farmers is false. And, you know, it's also important to look at, you know, who's growing what. And the people who are growing fruits and vegetables have always explicitly rejected programs like the commodity programs. They don't want to be regulated in that way, which is not to say that, you know, we can't find ways to bolster those people. And I think the USDA is actually doing really good work trying to do more of that. So, you know, it's way, you know, the Farm Bill is so complicated, and it really resists, you know, sound bites. I think there's serious issues with it, but there are also things that we need to preserve.
Mm-hmm. Can you touch on the SNAP program, what used to be the food stamp program? I know that's
sure.
A huge part of the Farm Bill, and most people don't realize that.
Yes, it is a huge part of the Farm Bill, and I think it's very important. And, you know, the fight that's going on over SNAP is one that it's pretty bitter and acrimonious. On the one hand, I think a lot of people are very committed to the idea that the least fortunate among us, or people who are just experiencing temporary hard times, have help. Nobody in this country should ever go hungry, and I think that there's agreement about that. We've seen pushback politically on the right, because the things that SNAP recipients buy tend to be just like the things that the rest of Americans buy. And so there's a lot of food that isn't particularly healthful. There's, you know, soda and sugary cereals get bought with SNAP dollars. And on the right, people are making the argument that perhaps taxpayer dollars shouldn't support the backbone of, you know, what's least healthful in our diet. And, you know, what I would like to see, that, you know, there's some efforts going on in different states to cut back on SNAP and to reduce and to cut back on some of the things that SNAP recipients can spend the money on. And so, for example, I think in Maine they're trying to make it so that soda can't be paid for with SNAP dollars. And those efforts, to me, feel very punitive and mean-spirited. And I would prefer to go back to a very fundamental idea, and that is that American taxpayers provide a safety net for people in need so that no one goes hungry. And if you look at a different nutrition program, the Women, Infant, and Children program, WIC, you see that those dollars are really only good for a very small group of staples, fruits and vegetables, grains, on the idea that kids need nutritious diets. But adults need nutritious diets too, and I would love to see SNAP and WIC combined and be good for, you know, a breadbasket of staples. And for me, that includes all kinds of fruits and vegetables. We can argue about what should be on the list. Frozen canned fruits and vegetables. I would include, you know, meat and seafood as well. Grains, staples like, you know, peanut butter and pasta, so that people have an option when times are tough. And then maybe we can stop focusing on the fact that, yes, poor people drink soda too, and we can start focusing on how we can get nutritious foods to the people most in need in the country.
Right. Yeah, I agree that, well, I personally would like to see soda not included, but, you know, when they were trying to not include sugary soda but still include diet soda, I don't think that's a benefit either. I think, you know, neither should really be included in the SNAP program, but I do think we need to focus on the healthier fruits and vegetables. And, you know, one of the complaints I've had a lot about the WIC program is that it doesn't give you a monetary amount where you can choose which milk and which eggs you want. You know, it's only allows eggs that are from conventional chickens and milk from conventional cows, which, you know, again, I'm concerned with the hormones, the antibiotics.
There aren't any hormones and antibiotics in milk. You know, I keep doing this, but you keep repeating the kinds of issues that it is my job to investigate. I have a column in the Washington Post that is supposed to look at the facts around these things. And if you look at the testing that happens on milk to detect antibiotics, you'll find that, I forget what the statistics are, but every now and then they find an antibiotic residue in a delivery, in a truckload of milk, and every truckload is tested. And it happens a fraction of a percent of the time, and that milk is discarded. As for hormones, of course there are hormones in milk. There are hormones in all kinds of milk. The question is whether there are more or different hormones in milk from cows that have been treated with bovine growth hormone. And again, the answer to that is no. And, you know, it's a frustrating thing, Bhavani, because you obviously care very much about the environment. You care very much about human nutrition. You want to see our food supply improved. But those efforts really have to be fact-based.
Well, I do believe they are fact-based. And, you know, I have read a lot and talked to a lot of people. And, you know, milk that is from conventional cows, I have read, have hormones and antibiotics in them.
I'm sure that many of your listeners have read the same thing. And, you know, when I first started writing the column, in my very first column, one of the issues that I addressed was not anything to do with food, but had to do with how humans arrive at decisions. And, you know, we all have a tendency to trust the people who see the world the way we do. And so lots and lots of things get traction on one side of the political spectrum or on the other. And if you look at climate change, it's a terrific example about how the division on what people believe about climate change is very much who's on the political right versus who's on the political left. And everybody believes that their position is based on science. And the thing that I try and do, and I think it's my number one goal in the column that I write, is to try first to understand my own biases and do everything I can to overcome them. And I spend a lot of time talking to, you know, the smartest people I can find who disagree with me. And I think that if you really want to change our food supply, you're talking about 10 things to do to change our food supply. Number 10 on my list was spend time with people who disagree with you. Because, you know, whenever there's an echo chamber, whenever people with like minds get together and try and come to a conclusion, they end up basically congratulating one another on the superiority of their understanding. And, you know, I went to an event in D.C. just a couple weeks ago that was funded by the biotech industry, and I brought them exactly that message, that if we want to have constructive conversations, you need to have people who don't the world the same way. And I know it probably makes for the kind of podcast that can be uncomfortable and is perhaps not what you're used to, but unless people who come from different points of view can talk about these things in a way that is civil and constructive, we're never going to make any progress.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with you on that, but, you know, just like when I was saying you'd have to, you know, look at who's funding the research, you know, you also have to look at who's funding, you know, and funding the reporter. I mean, you know, I'm sure you're aware, you know, that in the Freedom of Information Act, you know, it came out that you do lecture for and speak at events with biotech industry, and that you receive a lot of money from them, and that,
and
you know,
who exactly are you alleging has given me money?
Monsanto.
You believe that I have gotten money from Monsanto?
Well, you know...
You know, Bhavani, that's something that's an easy fact. It's either true or it's not true. And it isn't true. But that doesn't prevent you from saying it on the radio, does it? And
I'm just repeating when I was researching to, you know, to have the conversation with you.
Well, when you were researching, did you see where I disclose all of the money that I am paid and by whom?
No.
Well, I would suggest perhaps you work on your research techniques, because I think that transparency applies to journalists as well as everybody else. And to that end, I publish all of my speaking engagements and all of the sponsors of all of the conferences that I speak at. And what you'll find...
So you don't think that influences your opinion at all?
Well, if you don't know who the sponsors are, how could you allege how it would influence me?
Well, in this article that I was reading, they were saying...
Oh, you read it on the Internet, Bhavani?
Yes, I did.
You read it on the Internet. And because you read it on the Internet, you're willing to repeat it on the air without having checked it, without having asked me about it.
Well, that's why I'm asking you about it.
Because I am floating ideas that you find uncomfortable. And at first, you start with facts. But when facts don't cover it anymore, then you go to this, the thing you read on the Internet about how I'm bought and paid for by the biotechnology industry, which you did not bother to check the accuracy of. I mean, if you're talking about responsible journalism, which is what's at issue here, perhaps you should start at home.
Okay, well, thank you for setting me straight. I will do better research, and I will write you about it, correct it. But, you know, it does trouble me because, you know, I have been talking about these issues and reading about these issues for so long, and you're right. I mean, I definitely don't think GMOs are good. I think, you know, the increase of allergies and health issues that have grown since GMOs have been introduced into our food supply is outrageous, and I think they do correlate, and I think there's been very limited research because biotech companies...
If you're looking at correlations on increase in allergies, you will find that it directly corresponds with the increase of organic foods in our food supply as well. Do you think it's those?
No, because all of our food used to be organic before the chemicals started happening. You know, it's funny that conventional is the fruits and vegetables that are grown that are chemical-laden, and that organic is separated. You know, it used to be that, you know, everything was organic. But anyway, Tamar, we're just about out of time, and I would like to...
Probably a good thing, too.
Yeah, I would like to share with everybody your website so people can look you up and see what you're writing about, because I know you are incredibly knowledgeable, and I do respect you and thank you for coming on.
Can you share that
with everyone?
I do think that discussions among people who disagree is critical, and I'm always happy to have one.
Thank you. Thank you. I agree. And hopefully everybody, you know, is thinking a lot who is listening and is going to look up your website and do some research on their own. And the world will be a better place because of it. So thank you for joining us. Everyone out there, thank you so much for joining us. I'll see you again next week at the Food and Tech Summit. Bye for now.